This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is John Etherton, president of Etherton & Associates. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Roger. It's great to be back.
Well, I'm looking forward to another, as always, engaging discussion with you regarding all issues of procurement, whether it's on the Hill or just generally what's going on out there. And with that in mind, let's tackle healthcare.gov, okay, if you don't mind, John.
Sure.
We won't get anybody in trouble here.
No, that's fine.
Except maybe me. I don't know. But just in terms of healthcare.gov and all the focus on it, you know, I know you have some thoughts about what sort of the bigger picture is. I mean, that's a pretty big picture there, the healthcare, but just bigger picture from a procurement perspective,
right,
and what the implications are.
Well, I think you have to separate out the acquisition process behind the capability acquisition for healthcare.gov from the bigger political issues of the Obamacare, yay or nay, whatever. And I personally think that we're going to see, and already are starting to see, a lot of energy around the idea of reviewing the whole acquisition process around information technology, which really has been a continuing issue for the last couple of years. I think this is going to give, the controversies around this will give more energy to that whole effort and may drive it in some new directions. I think that the extent to which people can point to how much they were driven to certain acquisition strategies by the laws and the rules and that whatever the agency policies were in place at the time, I think will be on the table. It'll be interesting to see how all that plays out. But I think we've already started to see a manifestation of that in the during the Senate floor debate on the National Defense Authorization Act. Senator Shaheen introduced a companion to the Federal Information Technology Acquisition Reform Act, and I think the justification around that was trying to address what at least was presented as the issues with the healthcare.gov acquisition. So we're already seeing it, and I just think it's going to add a lot of energy to what people are already looking at. I don't, at this point, have any idea what direction it's likely to take or how closely the particular solutions that Congress will propose will be tied to things that actually happen with healthcare.gov, but I think it's, you know, it'll give a lot of impetus to what we're doing.
Right. Well, yeah, that's a great point. Just all this energy now, and it's got to go someplace, right?
Right.
It's like a, you know, it's like a hurricane or something. It's got, you know, but with that in mind, just let's first, to me, I you know, and we'll get into what that means in terms of the, you know, FITARA on the Hill or other focus on acquisition reform. But just with regard to healthcare.gov, it seems to me there's a couple, two or three areas. I just get your thoughts on it.
Sure.
You know, one of the, you know, requirements development, I think that's a big issue. That's always been a big issue in government, as you well know.
Right.
And in IT is, you know, even more complex in regarding basic commercial products and services. It's a complex area, or relatively complex. And the government seems to me does a fairly good job, or DOD does a fairly good job when they really think about and talk about building sophisticated weapon systems. Maybe they, you know, they go a little longer or they're over budget, but they
right.
actually do what they're supposed to do. That's why we have the best military in the world. You know, the focus in IT and buying, you know, acquiring solutions and that requirements development piece has always struck me as an area where it's the hardest to fix. And I don't know if there's a legislative fix, but it's an area where I think folks should focus on. I just get your thoughts on that.
Well, first of all, I think Congress, when they start really digging into these things, you always have to keep in mind that the end result, the real payout for Congress is a law. I mean, that's what they
right.
do. It's legislation.
Yeah.
It's
that's
not,
their product.
Right. It's not chopped liver. It's a law. So,
right.
so I think that's one of the things that folks are going to be driving, you know, in terms of an outcome. what's interesting to me about the healthcare.gov, and I will confess I haven't looked at it in depth, is the extent to which the enterprise they were about was basically setting up a portal which was sort of outside the government organization, which simply would allow, you know, folks to buy and shop for the various options for health insurance, versus anything that was actually intended to interface with the organizations within HHS and elsewhere. Because I think in the past, when I've looked at things like ERP acquisitions and things like that, one of the major issues is the extent to which folks will take a commercial solution or something that's been very proven as a solution in the private sector and try to deploy that within the government, and the degree to which the organizations, which really have to change to take advantage of those capabilities and really make them effective, are willing to do that, versus where people say, well, we want to keep everything the same internally, and what we're really interested in is figuring out a way to, you know, take this great idea, and then we'll do interfaces and workarounds and things like that and figure out some way. So we don't really have to change our process internally, but we can sort of have our cake and eat it too. And I think in the past, that hasn't been the most successful acquisition strategy.
Yeah, you know, that is a great point, John, because, you know, I'm sitting here thinking about you, that observation. And it is so true. The government can take sort of one or two approach. If they're going to buy a commercial solution, you take one or two approaches. They can buy a commercial solution that, you know, handles information and manages processes a particular way, and you can adjust your organization to sort of, you know, fit that particular tool or that enterprise tool. So you're not just, you know, buying an IT system. You're making cultural, you know, organizational changes to take advantage of the efficiencies available from whatever solution you're buying.
Right.
And that's something that the government really can. I mean, I've never seen it. I don't know about you, but when I was in government, I never saw that approach actually, you know, be embraced and accepted. But more traditionally is the other example you gave, the alternative, where the government buys a commercial solution and then seeks to tweak it to ensure that it meets the structural and organizational, I guess, needs or approaches or processes that already exist. And that just historically, that may not, you know, to your point, it might be an entire enterprise look as opposed to I'm buying this and adjusting it to our organization.
I mean, right. And I think, you know, that's where the real challenge is. And the other issue is in the government, where you have people who really see the opportunity to get the best out of these new technology tools. Where are they in the process in terms of managing change within the organization? And I think, and I see this in the Department of Defense and looking at the different services, they all have those sort of change agents at different levels and at different places. And depending on where that interfaces with the acquisition, you may get something that has at least a reasonable chance of success or something that basically doesn't work because you can't really mesh the two together without a lot of, you know, workarounds and things like that, which ultimately are much more expensive and create a lot more inefficiencies in the process. And so I think you have to, there's really no one size fits all approach to looking at those kinds of acquisitions. I think in the Obamacare issue, though, I wonder how much of that really was at play, rather as opposed to something that was essentially set up as an external type of a system or service that would provide for this service that the law required. And then really the issue there is more the various components, how they related to one another, what responsibilities were on the government side versus the integrator side, and some of the more traditional issues. And I think over the course of the next few months, I think a lot of that will be a much clearer and give us a little better sense of how this is going to play out in terms of new policy.
Yeah, sure. There's questions like, should the government have been the integrator? Should it hired an integrator? You know, that all be sorted out. You know, even questions about that I got were questions about the type of contract that was used, which is multiple award IDIQ, and you competed the task orders against it, right? That sort of thing. And whether, you know, that approach made sense for that particular requirement or not. And there's lots of factors that go into that acquisition planning. But it seems, you know, from you know, what we described in terms of, you know, acquiring a solution, I think the Sarah panel may have had, you know, it observed in the Services Acquisition Reform Acquisition Advisory Panel, you know, looked at requirements of development, and one of the recommendations they made or findings they found is that commercial organizations spend a lot of time and effort. They put together integrated teams to do these procurements at very high levels of the organization because they understand the success of their business is dependent on these solutions. And that's sort of, I mean, that's still, I think, a lesson that could be translated to the government.
Well, but if you think about the commercial imperative, I think, you know, they're out to make money. They've got sort of profit and loss and very good metrics for tracking success. And I think that that tends to override a lot of the institutional imperatives within companies, you know, for people protecting territories and relationships and that sort of thing. I think if you get into a situation on the commercial side, you're going to see the pressures from, you know, the general need to sell services and make money. That's going to push a lot of these other things to the side. I'm not so sure you've got the same imperatives on the government side. And so I think that how do you create that same mandate for changing and moving into a new organizational relationship to take advantage of the technology opportunities, I think is a real challenge.
Well, we have a mandate right now, John, that's for our first break. So when we come back, we'll be talking more to John Etherton, president of Etherton Associates. And when we come back, I want to touch on John's last observation regarding, you know, the stakeholders involved in the process. And then we'll move on to a little bit about what's going on the Hill, up on the Hill. And you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
In the ever-changing national security and IT environments, L3 delivers innovative, cost-effective solutions. As a Fortune 200 company, L3 offers customers global end-to-end services and solutions for large-scale systems. No matter the challenge, L3 has the agility, technology, and innovation required for mission performance. From cybersecurity to next-generation IT, L3's passion for its customers' missions drives its commitment to excellence. L3. Agility, innovation, performance.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is John Etherton, president of Etherton Associates. And hey, John, when we took the break, you were making another brilliant point, as always, with regard to, you know, just the difference between commercial entities and the government, and just the fact that when I brought up the idea of what commercial firms do and their ability to focus. Well, it is very profit-driven. There's a bottom line. There is one number that counts, right? And the problem here, I'll get your thoughts on this, but it seems to me the problem with government, or the challenge, not the problem, and it's institutional. You can even talk about it being, you know, going back to the founding fathers and the ideas of checks and balances, right? There are so many different stakeholders in the procurement process alone. Just whether if you use GSA as an example, you know, there's GSA, and with GSA, there's stakeholders like the IG, the Office General Counsel, you know, the management of the program, the contracting officers. They all have different perspectives and different views on how things should or shouldn't work. Then you've got OFPP and OMB, then you've got customer agencies, then you've got contractors, and there within the contractors, there's large businesses, small business, medium-sized businesses. Then you've got the Hill, the oversight from their perspective and things they're interested in. I mean, and you know, and then you've got different regions and different, you know, it just explodes in terms of the number of interests that get involved in a particular government process. And I just use the one I know as an example, and it makes a job much in some ways much, much more challenging than, you know, working in the private sector actually.
Well, I think it goes back to something that Paul Francis from GAO said to the House Armed Services Committee about 3 weeks ago at their big acquisition reform hearing, and he said, maybe we have the system that we want.
Right.
Maybe when you look at all of the different forces and things that go into it that and the outputs, this is exactly the system we want when you sum it all up. And I think that's really the issue, is that we have everyone claims to be serving, and I think with justification, some aspect of the national interest or the public interest or the taxpayers or whatever, however you want to characterize it. But that is not a benchmark that you can say in a specific case, go this way rather than that way, because it will depend on the time frames that you're looking at and a lot of other things. You may be looking at a specific procurement and say that the purpose of this procurement, like, for example, healthcare.gov, is to, you know, deliver this service to the taxpayers. But there also, I'm sure, were a lot of people looking over their shoulders about, well, but it's also in the way we do this about protecting the integrity of the process, using, you know, these kinds of specific contracting vehicles along the way and not in a proper manner, and also the institutional relationships in the longer term around that, to give some credence to protecting those or carrying those off in a certain way. And so how people interpret that based on the time frame and the scope of the project and whatever they're doing can be a very, you know, they get very different answers. So I think I just don't see anything emerging that sort of overrides all that and says, look, you know, if we don't make money, we're out of business. That I think in the private sector tends to drive the decision making in a different direction.
Yeah, you have a very a focused, right. Bottom line approach, right. That I think in many ways is easier to manage to and focus on, right? I mean, it may, you know, not that it's easy, but you know, but yeah. In government there are so many different stakeholders you have to deal with on any particular issue that or procurement or transaction that it does, like you said, maybe it's the system we have, the system we want, right?
Right. Sort of, ultimately.
Yeah. With that in mind, though, let's turn a little bit to what's going on up on the Hill with the mm-hmm. NDA, you know, the National Defense Authorization Act, and there's been a number of, you know, amendments proposed that a lot of them focus on an IT procurement, like you mentioned, FITERA in the first segment. So I'll turn it over to you.
Well, we have a kind of an interesting situation. The bills come up relatively late in the process on the Senate floor. As most people know, the Senate process is such that when a bill comes up, the amendment process is pretty unconstrained, at least at the beginning, until the members decide they want to limit it in some way. We had over 400 plus amendments, I think, that have been filed already on the bill, and that's, in my opinion, not news. It's kind of what happens every year. But what is interesting is that they worked through the whole process last week and didn't actually add a single amendment to the bill. So they haven't cleared any amendments. They haven't taken any votes to approve any amendments. They did disapprove a few. And then they were unable to get cloture to bring the debate to a close on Thursday afternoon. So they're coming back on the 9th of December in a very, very late time in the year to see if they can move the bill forward. And frankly, I'm a little skeptical whether they're going to get enough agreement around either a set of amendments that would be in order or that combined with a large manager's amendment with cleared amendments that would allow them to move forward and get the bill done in a couple of days.
Okay, so for our listening audience, when amendment is in order, what does that mean?
Well, basically it means that someone can bring it up and offer it. What happened at the end of the day on Thursday last week was that there was a cloture vote, which means that once that is agreed to, there's some very strict rules on what can be debated. They have 30 hours of debate, and you can spend no more than 1 hour on an amendment. There's very, very strict germaneness rules, which don't normally apply in a Senate debate, which means
it has to be related to the defense authorization.
Well, not only related to the defense authorization bill, but it has to be actually directly related to a provision that is in the bill.
Already.
It can't be something like a national defense interest type thing. There actually has to be language in the bill that you're amending. Okay. So it really tightens up that whole process. And there was no way, based on some of the things that the members wanted to do, that they could get cloture. And so Majority Leader Reid basically said was that we would go back to the bill on Monday the 9th at 4 o'clock and to get a status report from the managers on where they were on the bill. That's actually in the congressional record. And I think at that point it's going to be, well, where are we? Or do we have the basis for going forward? Is there some series of consent agreements, essentially, that would allow for the debate that the members want on whatever the amendments are and allow for cleared amendments that would allow them to immediately go to a reconsideration of the cloture vote and see if they can get cloture and then maybe finish the bill by midweek? And as I said, I'm a little bit skeptical that there's going to be enough comity and understanding and consensus around what could be in order or not in order, given the Iran sanction issue, the sexual assault issue, and a number of other issues. I'm just not sure they're going to get it all to a point where everybody's ready to say, yeah, these are the only things that we really need to talk about. So, well, we'll see what happens between now and then.
Are there any, you know, particular provision or proposed amendments that are, or first, just in the bill itself with regard to procurement, language? Is there anything of note that?
Yeah, I've actually gone through and looked and you know, came up with actually about 150 pages of amendments that were released in the acquisition policy area that were interesting. Of those, I think I mentioned Senator Shaheen's amendment, which would essentially import most of the Federal Information Technology Acquisition Reform Act language into the Senate bill, which means that if they finish the bill and they go to conference, essentially all those things that are in there would then, whether they're common between the two bills, would be automatically agreed to, and they wouldn't be, there wouldn't be any room for disagreement. There's some language on the transparency issue that Senator Udall introduced. Similarly, I think it's the Federal Information Technology Transparency Act or something along that line, that would increase some of the information that's available around what the CIOs and the agencies do, which is interesting. Senator Manchin, as we all expected, introduced an amendment which would take the cap on contractor compensation reimbursement under cost contracts, which is currently at $763,000, some change. And basically, the committee came out with a position in the bill to lower that cap to $487,000 as a baseline, and then they would escalate it using the Bureau of Labor Statistics Employment Cost Index in the future. Senator Manchin introduced an amendment which would take that baseline down to $230,000, which is the vice president's salary. And that is interesting and has some controversy around that. I don't know if that comes up for a discussion or a vote or not, but that's out there. There's also some language.
Right, okay, John, right there. We have to, no apologies necessary, but we do have to take our next break. But when you come back, we'll be talking more to John Etherton, president of Etherton & Associates, and we'll continue focusing on the NDAA and the amendments and what's going on there. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
This is an important time for the federal government, a chance for agencies to do things differently. How will you help shape your future? Turn to Deloitte. With our private sector insight and public sector experience, we'll help you rethink, reduce, and restructure, and turn resolve into results, so you can see what's possible and make it happen. See how at Deloitte.com/federal. Wherever you need to go, Deloitte sees you there.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we're talking to John Etherton of Etherton Associates. And, John, when we took the break, you were listing some of the amendments procurement related with regard that are being proposed for the NDAA. And before I let you continue the list, I wanted to ask you a little bit about, you know, the one that is always in the headlines and there's a lot of, to me, I hear emotion around on all sides is, or an angst or whatever, or energy or passion, I don't know what the right word, all those words. And that's the, reimbursement of executive compensation in cost reimbursement contracting and the different, in the varying levels and why, this going from 763,000 to 487 to now there's a proposal to do 230. What is that all about?
Well, this has been going on now, this latest round, for about the last 3 years. It really started, kicked off when the administration basically said a few years ago that they thought that an appropriate level for reimbursement of executive salaries, and they didn't use the word compensation, was the same level as a senior cabinet official, and they said it was around $200,000. That sort of empowered people who have been, fighting this issue for a while to come back and offer amendments to take the number down. We set up a mechanism back in the late 90s, which basically capped for the senior executives in the companies how much compensation we would reimburse. And it's more than salaries. It's bonuses, a number of other things, things that get normally reimbursed on as annual compensation under federal contracts. But in that legislation, we set in place an escalation formula, as it were, that basically it was based on what companies in the private sector were generally paying their senior executives. And since the early, mid-2000s, that number has gone up quite a bit. It's actually jumped about, on the average, about 8% a year. And so now we started out at $340,000 in 98, and now it's up around $763,000, and if it continued where it should be, it'd be closer to $950,000. And that causes some concern for people, especially in the economy, and after we went through what we went through in 2008. So the issue's back, and so there's been a lot of discussion around limiting how much the government under contracts will reimburse. The arguments are made that, hey, companies can pay these people whatever they want, it's just the government should have to reimburse it. But the fact of the matter is that the companies, in setting their compensation levels, not only for senior executives, but for everybody else, and this legislation now covers everybody, not just the senior executives, use the same industry surveys, benchmarks, and other kinds of things that companies normally do to remain competitive in their ability to hire talent for the various positions in the companies that they need. So basically saying to companies, the only way you can get this money, you can do this is by not, we're not going to pay you the full cost of that effort, but what we're going to make you do is basically dip into your profits, if you have any on a contract, and you pay it out of that, is essentially sending a signal to the private sector that the government will no longer, on a cost contract, reimburse you for reasonable costs for actually performing the contract. And that's, I think, where the big concern is. So we have a lot of these dueling sort of levels. The House bill has language in it which would set the level on a baseline level in FY14 at the current level, which is 763. It would make the total compensation of the top five executives in the overall corporation completely unallowable as a concession to some of the concerns that people have. And then going forward after FY14, the baseline would be reset by using this Bureau of Labor Statistics Employment Cost Index. The Senate bill just said $487,000. They just escalated the rate from 98 using inflation, used the same escalator from FY14 on as the House bill. And so that's sort of what's out there now. This has come up a couple of times on the floor. There was legislation to this effect, to the lowering the amount to $230,000 that Senator Manchin did offer on the immigration bill. It did pass when the only alternative on the Senate floor was the status quo. I'm not sure what happens if in a floor debate on the authorization bill when the alternative is not the status quo, but the language that's already in the Senate bill lowering the level to 487, which, by the way, the administration did endorse in their statement of administration policy. So I don't know where that all comes out, but that'll be something that we'll have to figure out.
Right. Well, it seems to me it's almost, I mean, I don't want to, I mean, when you describe it, I almost think it's like, it's another version of low price technically acceptable.
Right.
I mean, the idea of the government's, it's not a best value equation. And the government asks contractors to do some very, very complex, challenging work. And if at the same time, the government's going to limit what it's willing to reimburse a contractor for, you know, for their executives to help manage and perform that work, I think the government's shooting itself in the foot in the long run. I mean, it is because it does. At a certain point, you want talented people who the companies can attract and can pay to employ to perform lots of this complex work or manage a lot of this complex work. And I just think it's a short-sighted approach.
I agree with you. I think that it really basically says to companies, we want you to perform these very complex tasks, either delivering hardware or services, but yet we are not going to pay you and reimburse you for the cost of performing under the contract. And I think in the long run, that's not the signal that you
want to
send.
And you want the third stringer, right?
Right.
Instead of like Tom Brady.
Yeah.
Spoken as
but
a,
we still want to hold you accountable for the performance under the contract.
At a Tom Brady level.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So this is spoken as a Patriots fan here. So
it's okay.
We had, coming off that Denver victory.
And the number that they're using, again, is sort of this number that was developed under this earlier formula. But the cap of 47 or 230 or whatever, you're decoupling folks that are performing in the government space from any sort of sense of what's actually going on in the broader private sector. And I think the more you sort of drive a wedge between companies in one space and the other, the more you really are in the long run shooting yourself in the foot.
Right. And I think that, I think that that's a manifestation, too, that you could it helps contribute to limiting the supply chain in the long run.
Right.
I mean, because you are making even stronger distinction between the government federal market and the commercial market.
Right.
And the more you do that, companies make business decisions.
Right.
You know, I'm going to operate in the commercial market. It's more, there are more incentives for me to do a good job there than there are in the federal market.
Yeah.
It
doesn't happen overnight, but I think in the long run,
yeah.
I think that's
sure.
That's the trend.
I think there was another amendment you wanted to
mention. Yeah, just one more I wanted to mention. There's an amendment introduced by filed by Senator Coburn, which tracks the language in a bill that he and others introduced in September. It's S-1510. It basically deals with the government requirements to meet their auditability targets in the Department of Defense by FY2017, and there are a number of penalties for not successfully doing that in terms of the way the government can spend money and the way that they can move to milestones and acquisition programs. There's also an interesting Section 8 in this bill and in the amendment, which basically is not tied to the auditability issue at all, but simply says if you are buying this enterprise resource planning kind of system from based on a commercial model, that you cannot do so unless you can demonstrate that you can do a full deployment of that capability within a 3-year period, which is a pretty high bar, I think, given what we know about deploying those kinds of systems, especially in a government environment where you have the existing agencies and relationships and all the things that you want to talk about.
And infrastructure.
Yeah, right.
You got to transition.
But what's
the rationale behind that particular?
I don't know.
That's an interesting idea.
Well, I think the idea is to address some of the concerns things that have occurred in some of the past efforts by the government to deploy these systems, and basically to set up some sort of a boundary approach, which basically will say to the Department of Defense in this case, if you can't demonstrate that you can successfully do this, you can't do it to begin with. I think that's the way that they want to do it, and I personally think the 3-year time frame is fairly arbitrary, but I think the idea is that you bound it in such a way that things don't get started which don't have a reasonable chance of success. I'm not sure that you can work acquisition problems that way and be successful, but that at least is the philosophy, I think, in the language.
Right, but I'm just thinking about that too, that, you know, there's so many variables that go into that.
Right.
And funding is a big one of those, right?
Right.
I mean, funding for a particular program could be impacted from year to year. And, I mean, trying to turn to plan, I mean, just, it goes back to the whole issue of stakeholders and all
right.
that stuff and
right.
pressure points. But right now, hey, Jonathan, we're at our last break. But when we come back, we'll be talking more to John Etherton, president of Etherton Associates. And we'll discuss further. We'll talk a little bit about Fatera. Then we'll maybe the idea of another acquisition advisory panel, and just a little potpourri of what's going on out there. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
The mission of government involves critical efforts to improve national defense, economic security, health services, and citizens' lives. The strategy and technology consultants of Booz Allen Hamilton are proud to help government address cyber threats, reform the financial system, modernize infrastructure, and protect our nation. For nearly 100 years, Booz Allen has partnered with clients to deliver results that endure. To see Booz Allen's ideas in action, visit BoozAllen.com.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is John Etherton. John is president of Etherton Associates, and coming back from the break, we have been talking about the amendments to mm-hmm. the NDAA, and I know, you know, one of the first one you mentioned, I think, was Fatera. And is there anything in particular about Fatera that strikes, and that's the Federal Information Technology Acquisition Reform Act there.
Right.
Is there any particular section of that, you know, sort of strikes you or you've heard people talking about that's of interest?
There's a lot of stuff in Fatera. I mean, it's a big piece of legislation. Basically a whole division in the House bill. Some of the provisions have been, you know, people have been somewhat critical of. I think there's some things in there that are actually fairly positive. I think the language in there dealing with the CIO and the authorities and getting clarity around that and trying to have a more coordinated approach both within an agency and across agencies on those kinds of procurements. I think that's an interesting conversation that we need to have. You know, I look at sort of the evolution in a very simplistic way of IT in the government. And, you know, going back to the era when we had the Brooks Act and, you know, sort
sure.
of mainframe computers and the desire to sort of have these, you know, more centralized acquisition models around that. Then we went to a more distributed, you know, sort of PC-based model with the, you know, local area networks and all that sort of thing, and something that was a lot more sort of a network rather than something based on a mainframe. And now we seem to be going more to a sort of a backbone approach in which everything sort of feeds into a backbone. And so it's not the same as the mainframe, obviously, but I think it does say, you know, is the structure and the way we buy IT and agencies really adapted or sort of focused on the best way to do sort of those sort of backbone-based IT systems and agencies, and so I think this has been a good conversation to have around some of that.
Right. Well, at the same time, like taking advantage of latest, you know,
right.
the latest innovations in technology,
right.
whether
right.
you know, the you know, just that, handheld devices and PDAs and right, all that right, sort of right, thing, right? So, right. I have to agree with you. The CIO provisions are pretty interesting, greater sort of concern or scratching your head is a lot of this reorganization of the procurement functions and whether that's really necessary or not, or whether you're just going to create more confusion in the long run. I mean, it's probably good to have a conversation about those things.
Right.
And are there ways to improve them? But I think, a wholesale sort of reorganization that might be contemplated is a bit, I think, is a bit too much for the system to.
Well, and I would
others just, would say, yeah, it's the shock you need.
But. Well, it's interesting. I'm going to be interested to see, obviously, what comes out of the NDAA process where that bill is now lodged. But it's been interesting to me to watch the agencies and their reaction to the bill. It's been sort of mixed, I guess would be the best way to describe it. And I contrast that with the way that the Department of Defense essentially dealt with the Weapons Systems Acquisition Reform Act in 2009, where they did have some concerns and they sort of worked with both the House and Senate on that. But I think in general, they seem to have embraced a lot of the major components of that bill on cost estimating and some of the other organizational changes. And seem to have gone and done a pretty good job of rigorously implementing that. I don't get the same sense that the agencies are
sort of on board.
Yeah,
on
board with the organizational changes. And my experience historically, just working things like this historically, is if the agencies aren't, you can't get them on board at least to see the inner logic or the inner policy drive behind something like that. It's very difficult, even if you pass a law, to get a really solid implementation of an
idea. It's almost like, is there a strategic approach to
right.
this or not?
Yeah.
You don't get a sense of that.
I don't think people see it emerging necessarily from it. I mean, people argue that it's there and they go back and forth, but I think that's one of the things I think they still have to work out.
Yeah. So, one of the things that we hear a lot of talk these days too in the procurement community is the idea of doing another sort of panel. I mean, we've done, 800 panel, there's a SARA panel. GSA even did a panel on the schedules program back in the day, about 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago. What's your thoughts on the idea of another sort of panel to take a look at the procurement system? And, there's conversation around this, just, the healthcare.gov, which
right.
we touched in the first segment of the show, the idea of like, we need to do something. Is this a way, and then I'd sort of, be cynical. How does that dovetail with the Congress's goal of having to pass a law, right? That's their product. So,
I think we're in a situation that we were in, frankly, right before we set up the Section 800 panel in the late 1980s, in which there's been a fairly significant amount of legislation, I would say massive amount if you add it up over the last 5 or 6 years, looking at Title 8 of the various National Defense Authorization Acts. And I think it's time to sort of have a time to sit down and sort of sort that out. But what you really are going to need, in my opinion, if you're going to do a commission like this, is you have to have a real sense of purpose. What is it that you want the acquisition process to reflect? What values do you want it to reflect? What sort of initiatives do you want to sort of build into that effort? And I think I'm not sure that the 800 panel had that understanding at the beginning, other than a relatively modest one of trying to reconcile all the different things that were seemed to be incompatible that had been, worked into the law in the previous 10 years before that. And they sort of shifted from that to looking at how do we make the system more open to commercial items, commercial technologies, commercial services. And that sort of seemed to be what drove the overarching framework that they came up with in their recommendations. I'm not sure that we have a consensus around something that strategic
right.
in the way we're doing it now. And I think that would be an important component. But I would also say that there seems to be a real strong political bias, at least on the Hill, against setting up one of those commissions. Because we proposed it in a number of different ways to deal with modest things like depot policy to the very broad issues of acquisition policy. And it's just something that over and over again people have said, we don't want to set up another commission. So I don't know. But if they ever do it, I would use the Section 800 panel as a model.
As a model.
Yeah. It got the right people in the room, which were representatives of industry, representatives of the legal community, and representatives from the Department of Defense and the other agencies. And so you had all of them sitting at the table, It was very well resourced because they did it down at the Defense Systems Management College, and DoD had a pretty strong budget. And the scope of it was fairly clear. In other words, all they were looking at were the statutes. They were not looking at regulations. They were not looking at policies, but simply focusing on the statutes. And I think even with that, it took them 3 years, but they came up with a fairly focused product at the end. That's the kind of effort I think that would be the most fruitful, as I would contrast it with the Sarah panel, where you and I were both involved, where we had just a very broad scope of just, it was essentially everything. And
right.
I think it was much harder in that, especially given the lack of resources that we had to do it. It was very difficult to get
when you look at the report, it is very distinct, chapter by chapter,
right.
Very different topics.
Right.
Right. They're all interrelated because of procurement, but
right.
Very different. And
right.
So you say, I mean, to me, it's like have a specific, identify the mission, keep it simple, and provide the resources to do it,
right.
If you ever get around to doing
that's
it.
That's right.
Yeah. So, hey, so, and speaking of resources, I wanted to, you know, because we're running out of time, and I did want to touch on this a little bit, and just, you know, sequestration, sort of where we are, and we're looking at, you know, we're coming, it's be January soon, right?
Right.
Isn't that
right.
When things start clicking again?
Right.
Or what?
Well, and we have the situation.
Or not clicking. Right?
Yeah, we have the budget committees are meeting, the two the leaders of the committees are trying to come up with some sort of a framework for FY14 and FY15, one of their goals, if they can reach it, is to try to come up with a way of lessening the burden of sequestration. Right now, the tea leaves don't look too good for that happening, but we can see what happens in the next couple weeks. I think if sequestration moves in sort of unimpeded into FY14, we are going to have some real serious problems, and I mainly focused on the Department of Defense. But one of the things I think people don't realize, and Arnold Pinaro has been around town pointing this out and others as well, is that sequestration is directed against budget authority, not budget outlays. And so there's going to be a delay in when the outlay effects really start to occur. And that combined with the fact that in FY13, when sequestration was first put in place, you had a lot of prior year unobligated balances, which could be used as offsets, essentially, to buy off the impacts. Well, in FY14, you're not going to have the unobligated balances to nearly that significant a degree, and what you are going to have is the outlay sort of building up, the outlay impacts, and whereas in FY13, we were looking at about a $10 billion cut in actual outlays, in FY14, and for the Department of Defense, it comes out to about $40 billion. And so these things are going to be, the party's really going to be over in terms of making things easy and workable and really dealing with the impacts on the modernization account. So I think we're going to be in for a real rocky road next year.
Well, you know, John, on that note, we're out of time today. Happy holidays, right?
Right.
I want to thank my guest, John Etherton, president of Etherton Associates, for joining me today. And you have been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf. Only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.